Welcome everyone to the session. If you're like me, the topic certainly caught my attention when I saw big data. As someone working in life insurance, we see tons and tons of data, and it's probably questionable to what extent we're really making the best use of that. So I was very keen to participate in this session and volunteer to chair. And today, Melissa Neumeyer is going to talk to us about how big data can help transform the competitive landscape of business. Melissa is a senior consultant at Quantium, working with a team of analysts to deliver insights using data on the Australian consumer behavior. With clients spanning retail, property, insurance, and banking, she sees firsthand the impact that data can have in understanding the multiple factors that influence the success of a business. Prior to working at Quantium, Melissa worked at a privately owned trading company, Susquehanna, as an equity derivatives trader for 7 years, and prior to that as an analyst at Citigroup. Melissa studied actuarial science and commerce at the Australian National University. And just to put the whole issue of data a little bit to the test, I thought that I'll go and Google her and see how much more data I can get on Melissa. So I found on her LinkedIn profile that she has 259 connections. I'm not always sure if that's an embarrassment or an achievement. I think for an actuary, that's not bad. I also found that, given that interesting surname, she's fluent in German, and also that she's a cycling enthusiast. Now, not being satisfied that's enough, I thought I'll go through another link on Google, and I found some more information that was probably a little bit too much information on Twitter. I found that she's got 195 connections or people that she's following on Twitter and 88 people that follow her, which makes her probably pretty active on Twitter. And then a whole stream of information of tweets that's got a lot of cycling in there that I decided that I'll probably step away from and stop reading at that point. Now, in meeting up with Melissa yesterday, I also found that this passion of hers on cycling has actually made a queen of the mountains on some of the cycle races that she's been participating in. So she's clearly an avid racer in the cycling world. Now, with all that information and data that we have available on our speaker today, I'm going to hand over to her and let her talk to us about how data can transform the competitive landscape of business. We'll take questions at the end of her presentation. Thank you.
Thanks. Good morning, and thank you, Andre, for that introduction. The competitive environment in which businesses are operating today demands the very best of its leaders when it comes to decision making. There's a decreasing margin for error, and decisions can have serious consequences through lost productivity, missed opportunities, bad prioritisation, and wasted money. Ineffective strategies can be disastrous. While I'm sure that no one gets it right every time, we need to maximise the chance of success, and decisions, therefore, need to be made to the best possible standard. If you use the right tools, the odds of success increase. And this, increasingly, demands the use of data. Being able to quantify the problem and possible outcomes using mathematical models can help us identify real risk-return metrics, as opposed to basing decisions on assumptions. Data can help us to contextualise the situation. And taking it one step further, it can also enable us to extrapolate future possibilities. I think actuaries can play an integral role in transforming data into meaningful insights with powerful predictive capabilities. In fact, so critical to the future way in which businesses will be operating, there's some people who have an influence over what is on the cover of Harvard Business Review at the very least, who think that data scientists are going to be unbelievably in demand. However, despite being heralded as the sexiest job of the 21st century, it does seem that finding people with the right skill set, that is, technological know-how combined with a creative bent on problem solving, is somewhat challenging. Henry Ford once said, "If I had asked the public what they wanted, they would have asked for a faster horse." Sure, this might not be a decision that was heavily influenced by data necessarily. But the point I want to get across here is that real innovation comes from doing things a different way to what you've always done in the past. Actuaries, or data scientists, we should look for opportunities to think outside the box and to come up with creative solutions to old problems. We should ask questions, explore ideas, and challenge the status quo. Doing things the way that they've always been done, whether it be trying to breed a faster horse or whether it's doing business the way that we always have, limits innovation and stifles opportunities. The breakthrough with the invention of the car came from the innovative approach to a problem. So, how can data help us? For example, it's generally acknowledged that data is particularly useful when it comes to understanding customers. There's a lot of information out there, but if you base your segmentations on old standard styles of measurement, things like census data or ABS data, you can start making some pretty big assumptions about your customers. Consider the following. Men aren't as simple as you think. Here's a little bit of a who am I, using the descriptors that you have access to when you use census data. Male, born in 1948, remarried with multiple children, and educated. Who am I? I came up a little bit quick. Okay. Based on the broad aggregated style of data, you would be mistaken for thinking that Prince Charles and Ozzy Osbourne look like the same person. And if you try to pitch a business idea to them based on treating them as the same sort of person, you'd probably be at a competitive disadvantage. But by incorporating different data, things like internal customer data or external data, we can avoid making some of these mistakes. We start to develop a more accurate picture about what it is that makes this person tick. Things like the websites they visit, or the travel destinations, taste in fashion and music, hobbies, all allude to a better behaviour profile of an individual. And this means that the insights that you're able to draw, and the decisions that then you can make, become much more powerful in their ability to cut straight to the segment that you're looking to target in a way that resonates with them. So if we think of the spectrum of data sources that we could use to help us in generating insights and guide our decision making, on one end we would have things like publicly available aggregated information, things like the ABS or census data. It's really good for explaining broad trends and averages, but it probably struggles a little bit in that it's retrospective and also unlikely to be particularly timely. Next along, we might have something like industry data. It's better, but again, it's not particularly specific and it's unlikely to be timely. Then we move into more interesting space. We start incorporating internal data. Things like the customer information that you get from loyalty programs combined with sales statistics. Now we're starting to get to an area that there's potential to add value here. And lastly, I want to consider external data. This can come in all sorts of forms, but things that come to mind are things like transactional data, website activity, real-time news feeds, and that sort of thing. This truly provides a different lens through which you can observe the industry in which you're working. By incorporating these into your segmentation, you're now starting to get a clearer understanding of Prince Charles versus Ozzy Osbourne. They both may be men in their 60s, but I doubt that their Twitter feeds look remotely alike. With limitless information and unlimited imagination, what could be created? So where does your industry sit? On the spectrum of utilising data in innovative ways, on the left, you'd have your traditional way of doing business, one that might rely on gut feel, producing reports that are a little bit retrospective in nature. On the other extreme, you have innovative businesses that are data-driven, using analytics and modelling to create predictive and forward-looking insights. There's definitely some industries and organisations that are further along the path towards the innovative end of the spectrum. Let's go through some examples of what I believe to be some of the more progressive ideas, and then we'll get back to this question. sorry. Before we go any further, I'd also like to take some time to consider the way in which we should approach a decision. First, can we all agree that the best possible chance of success does not involve just doing what you did last time, nor does it involve a dartboard or crossing your fingers and hoping for the best. Rather, quite a few studies have been looked into how the best outcome might be achieved. This is one such take on the process. First of all, you need to identify the problem and articulate why it is you need to solve it. The next step, you need to assemble information. Any information you have at your disposal can assist us in contextualising the situation. Define possible outcomes and, if you can, assign a probability. This is a step that we'll be focusing on today, as it's during the accumulation of information that data is the most relevant. Using the information gathered, we can test hypotheses, create evidence, and attempt to distinguish correlation from causation. Then, during the interpretation of results, it's up to the decision maker to apply logic, experience, judgment, and select a course of action. Once a decision has been made and executed, it is also important to measure the results. This provides a feedback loop and also helps to inform future decisions. While the application of logic and experience is a critical step, can we also just take a minute to recognise that there are some common pitfalls when it comes to decisions? It's not uncommon to be overconfident in what you believe you know. Decisions, however, should be based on fact, not gut feel. Assuming expertise and knowledge can cloud the drive to search for more evidence and can lead to anchoring and cognitive bias. It's human nature to prefer to seek out or to pay more attention to evidence that supports our beliefs. But it's really important to look for more than just confirming evidence. The good news is that it turns out that data can help us here too. So where can data help businesses to make better decisions? One industry that I believe relies on making good decisions is trading. While the success of a trading strategy can ultimately be boiled down to the concept of buy low, sell high, the methods used in reaching these decisions are more complex. For the purposes of illustration, let's focus on a market that I'm most familiar with, exchange-traded options. And let's follow it through some of the major decision-making changes over time. Options, as we know them now, are a relatively modern concept. They were first listed for exchange to be traded back in the 1970s, and back then there was relatively little known as far as pricing them was concerned. It would be fair to say that it relied quite substantially on gut feel. Back in the day of open outcry trading floors, market makers would start each day with an idea of what they thought the options were worth, and as the day progressed and stock prices moved and orders came in, they would compute in their heads the new fair value of the options. The better traders were obviously the ones who were good at calculating whether or not a trade was good or not. The decision to trade was based on numerous inputs, things like the changing underlying price, but ultimately it came down to assumptions, best guess and gut feel. Now, who am I to say that the old methods aren't valid? However, if you were faced with the need to improve the probability of success in such an industry, the most obvious place to start would be to look at how to utilise the available data more effectively. The biggest development in the pricing of options occurred when Fisher Black and Myron Scholes used stochastic partial differential equations to estimate the price of options over time. In developing this model, the market was on its way to better incorporating relevant data into its trading decisions, with the Black-Scholes formula now forming at least the basis of modern option pricing. The guidelines we went through earlier on effective decision making, that is, using data that's been run through a model to form a baseline of fair, not anchoring but seeking non-confirming evidence, overlaid with an application of logic, are all true in the case of trading. This then underlies the developments that trading has since gone through. You're constantly told you're only as good as your last trade. Don't get married to your position. Be vigilant in your decision making. And as a result, you're always asking yourself, what is the new information? Is this order significant? What does it imply as far as the stock price, the volatility, or the dividends? All of this needs to be factored into your decision and also forms the basis of what you believe to be the new fair. That is, the information gets fed back into your input to help you trade more effectively. Clearly, the most noticeable change to this industry is the platform on which it now occurs. No longer do we have open outcry pits with traders in colourful jackets and chalkies writing up prices. Now, market makers and traders sit in trading rooms behind a wall of computer screens and send their orders electronically. Behind these screens are various algorithms continually refreshing bid offer prices in response to movements in underlying data, ready to pounce on anything juicy that might come into the market. The decision to buy or sell on such an occasion is often informed by limits set beforehand as to the edge required and under what circumstances the sniper is allowed to trade. The reason automation has been developed is now speed has become critical to success. The fact is that only the fastest trader is going to get the good trades, and the days of a human making a decision and calculating in their heads are for the most part gone. The new options maker is one of a subset of what you could loosely call algorithmic traders. Algo trading, in simplified terms, involves the execution of pre-programmed trading strategies upon input of various data inputs. These strategies require little to no human input once they have been created and heavily back-tested to ensure maximum likelihood of success. Commonly referred to as black box trading, it can range from simple VWAP machines to the complexity of high-frequency trading. High-frequency traders have taken the decision-making process to the next level in a bid to be the fastest. They make money by essentially predicting price movements almost at the instant that new information comes to hand and initiates a trade of its own accordingly. For these traders, the greatest chance of success really does rely on being the quickest to respond to new data, and considerable effort goes into modelling price movements and predicting the likely next direction. The trader's job is to apply the finesse around the edges of the model, incorporating new information and calibrating it to perform optimally. To me, this represents the ultimate progression in using data to make business-impacting decisions. So financial markets are one example of an industry that has embraced the move to incorporating data into an improved decision-making process. Where else are the opportunities? As actuaries, you're uniquely placed to be at the pointy end when it comes to driving innovation in this area. I mentioned earlier that customer segmentation is a big user of data, and nowhere is this more prevalent than in the retail world. Especially when we're talking about highly commoditized products, everyone is searching for a differentiator and a way of increasing incremental sales. In this example, the focus was increasing the probability of the sale of a product. By analysing transaction and basket level data, the purchasing patterns of people buying a particular type of crisp bread were monitored. Through analysis of customers' shopping baskets, it was determined that people were very likely to purchase certain other items at the same time. And those happened to be tinned tuna, cheese, tomatoes and avocados. Basically, it was someone looking to have a nice and healthy lunch. This is a behavioural style of segmentation, and you're not going to get it from your simple age and gender and geography style segmentation. The power of this is it allows you to tap into someone's psyche when they're making a buying decision, and it potentially allows you to influence the outcome. Based on this analysis, a promotion was put in place such that the crisp bread was also placed in the fresh section near the tomatoes and avocados. Seems simple, right? But the decision to implement this was only made after the hypothesis was able to be tested and validated using the data. The result was an incremental increase in sales of up to 100%. A good result, I'm sure you'd agree. So how could financial services do the same sort of thing? Things like bundling products and services are a direct comparison. Things like selling income protection insurance alongside homelands, for example. Obviously, the insurance industry has been using data and actuarial techniques for years to build pricing models and calculate the expected risk profiles of all manner of things. The kinds of segmentation will ordinarily incorporate things like age, gender, and postcode when determining an appropriate level of risk. But what about other information? At the simple end of the spectrum, assigning a user pays approach to car insurance is already being applied in some instances. That is, premium can be a function of the kilometres driven. But what else is there? What about if we try and incorporate some sort of behavioural segmentation? So I've been recently looking at buying a new car, and it strikes me that the technology that is being used these days, particularly when it comes to safety, is remarkable. You've got things like lane assist checking your blind spots for you, lane departure warnings in case you start to drift around, adaptive cruise control, monitoring the distance between you and the car in front of you. Then you've got emergency brake assist should you need it. All of this is being registered by the car. It might fall short of having an internal camera tracking whether or not you're on your phone while you're driving. I'm sure you could agree that the information that is being recorded about your driving, it's probably pretty easy to paint a picture about your relative risk exposure when it comes to having a car accident. If this were true, pricing car insurance premiums accordingly could be much more based on individual circumstances. The old pricing levers, things like age and gender, are all very broad-based assumptions, and they would have you believe that people who look a certain way have a similar risk profile. But by allowing actual driving behaviours to influence risk profiles, we're in a much stronger position to make an accurate pricing decision. One area in which actuarial techniques are being transferred to a non-traditional field is in marketing. You may not have heard of John Wanamaker, born in 1838 and often referred to as the pioneer of marketing. But he was famously quoted as having said, "Half the money I spend on advertising is wasted. The trouble is, I don't know which half." It turns out that this is just as relevant today as it was back then, with seemingly no clear way to get to the bottom of this problem. Well, there may be a way to at least address the relative effectiveness of your strategy. In this particular example, a bank had an idea that it should be able to have a way of measuring the effectiveness of various advertising channels. They had attempted to calculate the impacts of advertising campaigns in the past, but this was limited to simple period-on-period comparisons as well as conducting some basic qualitative surveys. It did serve to illustrate that there was an uplift in sales at certain times, but it was impossible to separate the individual causes. Was it causation or simply correlation? What were the primary drivers for increased performance? They wanted to be able to isolate the factors that were contributing to changes in sales. The methodology applied was one that you're no doubt familiar with, insurance cost modelling, the goal being to measure the pure effects of each of the factors. Without going into the particulars, what was discovered was that in actual fact, the biggest contributors to an uplift in sales weren't the channels that were originally favoured. In fact, there were two other channels that had a significantly greater impact on sales. The implication of this was that the current allocation of marketing resources was less effective than it could be. Armed with the new information, the marketing team was then able to tailor a far more optimal channel mix. Ultimately, it resulted in a more efficient allocation of their advertising budget and a reduced cost per sale. In one case, this is up to 9 times lower than prior to the implementation of the model. In another media example, an insurer was looking for the best TV advertising exposure for its travel insurance product. A media agency using the old style of segmentation suggested that they sponsor the show Getaway. Maybe not a bad idea, but based on an assumption that those who enjoy to watch the escapism of a travel show are also keen travellers themselves. The data, on the other hand, allows us quite a different view of things. On the right, we see the geographic distribution of getaway viewers, the red and the orange areas having the highest penetration. The left, on the other hand, gives us the same geography, but with vastly different penetrations when we look at people who are actually travelling overseas. It would suggest that the insurer would be much better off promoting its travel insurance products to customers who are travelling more often. To get this perspective, however, relied on seeking external data. It allowed a view of the market that challenged the old-school way of thinking about the problem. In this case, the non-confirming evidence proved to be very insightful. When making asset allocation decisions, investors such as superannuation and investment funds are generally faced with a decision between some combination of cash, equities, bonds, and property. One such investor was interested in understanding the future retail property industry, and in particular, the impact of online sales to their portfolio. When you consider that the future income of a retail property is a function of the sale of its tenants, it makes sense that the property owner had a distinct interest in understanding what future sales may look like. Also, when you think that the duration of a retail tenancy can run from 5 to 10 years, it means that the mix needs to be right not just now, but also into the future. The old standards for measuring future sales may have involved data sources such as the ABS, some industry averages, and possibly some retrospective centre sales. You run some summaries, pick a growth rate, make some assumptions about the future of the industry, and you may have a report that goes so far as to claim to predict the future. But what about now? How can we improve the accuracy of this forecast? What can we do better? By incorporating external data, it's possible to look at specific situations and adjust for these accordingly. It turns out that the progression of the online retail maturity is affected by a multitude of factors. Once you allow for the type of category, whether it be fashion, department stores, food, or so on, the demographics of an area, the level of online maturity, whether you've got a region of early adopters or mainstream, geographic skews and so on, it can result in a forecast that is far more representative of the property that you're looking to understand. Through combining the factors, it's possible to extrapolate future online retailing trends much more accurately and calculate relative risk metrics. These can then enable property managers and investors to understand their current and future exposure to the online retail market of Australia. Putting parameters around future scenarios provides a basis for planning and decisions surrounding the optimal tenancy mix and the optimal asset allocation. One area in which the consequences of poor decision making can be severe is in the purchase of a business. When you're considering a target for acquisition, the due diligence in ensuring that it's a good fit, financially viable, and strategically sensible requires considerable research. From there, you have to establish a fair value, and that's also not straightforward, but it's critical to being able to negotiate and come to an agreement on price. When considering a fair value, you have your standard accounting methodologies, things measuring assets, liabilities and future cash flows and so on. But what if you could find a way to measure other intangibles, things like customer loyalty? Or even better still, what if you had a theory that in purchasing a business, you would be able to somehow create value in a way that the current business owners hadn't even considered? It could prove a costly mistake if the value that you assign to this is greater than the reality. But how might you go about testing your hypothesis? Let's consider an actual case study in which Woolworths were investigating the possibility of purchasing a small online shopping company called EasyBuy. As part of their information gathering process, one of the things that they sought to understand was whether there was additional value that could be leveraged by Woolworths if they purchased the company. To elaborate, given the relative sizes of the two businesses, it seems unlikely that in buying EasyBuy, that Woolworths would be buying access to a new customer base. The fact is that most people in Australia are probably already a customer of Woolworths. On the other hand, the inverse of the situation could be valuable. That is, what if within Woolworths' customer base there's a sizeable group of people who would be very interested in what EasyBuy has to offer them, but they just don't know it yet? Could Woolworths extract extra value from EasyBuy through marketing the new company's product to existing customers? To test the hypothesis, a GLM was performed on the group of customers to isolate the factors that contribute the most to explaining a particular type of behaviour that we were seeking to identify. As it turned out, the hypothesis that there was a subset of Woolworths customers was true. Not only did it exist, but it was able to be measured. Being able to measure with some degree of statistical certainty allowed the team at Woolworths to put parameters around their theory into the valuation model of EasyBuy. The information learned from the exercise all fed into the ultimate decision that Woolworths management made to purchase the online retailer. The fact is that there is an ever-increasing amount of data being generated, and chances are that hidden within this information is that can transform the way just about any business operates. However, I do think that we have a long way to go when it comes to incorporating the power of this data into the way that businesses are run. The examples I went through today are real, but by no means have these practices become the standard. It's our job as actuaries, analysts, and consultants to explore the possibilities and to ask the right questions of the data. We're in a unique position. The challenge for us is to identify the opportunities and find value. By applying our skills in modelling, testing and problem solving, we can help to unlock the power and information contained in the data. In doing so, the insights that we form will become an integral step in the way that businesses work, ultimately leading to better decisions, greater efficiencies, a competitive edge and bigger profits, all thanks to the help of data. So back to the question I put to you at the beginning. Where do you think your business or industry sits on the development path of data and analytics? Any volunteers?
Probably a good segue for us to go to the question. Thank you, Melissa. I would challenge you to think about that and maybe give your comments as we go through this question and answer section now. We've got about 15 minutes for questions and answers. And before we get into it, just a reminder to please complete the survey on FSF Connect on the session and give us your feedback on the session. When we do go through the questions now and answer time, can I please ask you to step up to the microphone? Please speak clearly. These sessions are being recorded. And please state your name before you ask your question. And when you do have comments, please try to keep them down to 2 minutes. A very insightful presentation. Thank you, Melissa. The first question or the first thought that jumps into my head as you spoke, and as we spoke yesterday beforehand as well, was the concept of privacy. Just Googling you and finding all that information on you made me wonder how much of this world of data is really possible in the space of privacy concerns, and how do companies like Quantium get around the problem of privacy?
Well, I think it's definitely something that you need to be aware of. If you're working with people's data, you also have to be aware of the responsibilities that go along with that. And the policies on privacy are pretty clear, and I guess no business opportunity can breach those. You need to have that in mind.
We don't have the opportunity to do questions here on the screen, so if you do have questions, please do walk up to the microphone. We have one coming from the audience now.
Thanks, Melissa. You mentioned in your presentation something which... Sorry, it's David Schneider. And you mentioned in your presentation something I agree with and support, that one has to be very careful about the differences between correlation and causation. I was curious, how do you, at Quantium, actually test for the differences between correlation, co-integration, causation? Do you use things like Granger causality tests, or are you using other techniques?
Was that in relation to any particular example, or just generally?
Just generally, yeah.
I suppose that's where the having people with actuarial backgrounds is particularly useful, because you do have at your disposal a whole range of techniques that, running simple summaries and one-ways, it might tell you something, but it might tell you the wrong thing. So by trying to isolate factors so that they're not being influenced by others is, I think, very important in trying to distinguish between correlation and causation.
I think it links in with a question that I had that follows on that. It's really about how businesses are responding to your approach to say, we believe you have data, we believe you can make better use of that, and we think you can change the way or improve the way in which you do business. And I'm thinking of the life insurance industry, an industry that's probably regarded as a little bit stale, a little bit old, very traditional, very conservative actuaries. How do you typically find companies respond when you show up and say, give us your data and we can make you do business better?
Well, it doesn't work quite like that. But generally, it's because they've recognised a business need within their business, something they're not able to understand, but they think that there must be a way of understanding it. And I guess going to an external, like a consultancy, means that you're seeking a different perspective on your problem, and seeking the expertise of actuaries can potentially unlock what is within your data. A lot of the times the data is already there, it's just that no one's looked at it in that particular way.
It's really bringing it to the surface, as we said.
Yes.
Beforehand. Any more questions from the audience?
Hi, I'm Steve Gold. You mentioned the power of augmenting your data set with external data. Is that external data becoming harder to come by, or is it getting easier? So is there more data being released, or is some of the data people realise the power of that and maybe locking up exclusivity or charging more for it?
I think a lot of the times when it comes to external data, the first challenge is thinking about what it might be. So things like, I don't know, we talked about Twitter earlier. It's all there. It's publicly available. But figuring out a way to use it is the challenge. And same with our online activities or whatever it might happen to be. The first step is coming up with a way that it might be able to solve a problem. As far as locking up exclusivity and the like, I'm not sure that I necessarily have an opinion on that. To me, it seems like the first challenge is coming up with an idea.
I believe companies like LinkedIn doesn't make its data available to the market, or it's individually publicly accessible, but you can't use the data set of LinkedIn in the same way that you could potentially use other publicly available data sets. And I'd imagine the same with Everyday Rewards. I mean, how do you get around those sort of limitations? Some information is publicly available and some not.
Well, then... I'm not really sure I know the answer to that.
So it's really just a question of what you can use and what you can't, but clearly there's more opportunities out there.
Yes, I would say there probably are.
All right. Anthony?
Anthony Weiss. I think it's a fascinating topic, and thanks for the presentation. One of the challenges that I see with big data is almost by definition it's big. How do you... A lot of the examples we see, the ones that you presented and also ones that are presented elsewhere, are sort of successful applications of big data. It seems to me that one of the biggest challenges, though, is knowing what questions to ask of the data. So how do you go about doing that? Is it a question of just, is it sort of inspirational or perspiration? Do people just get lucky and ask the right question of the data, or is there a systematic process of actually running through data to allow the insights to emerge?
I guess I can only speak from my experience in this particular, to that particular point, but I think that the first step seems to be identifying a business problem, and then being able to think, okay, what might we have at our disposal that might help us answer that? And then by performing some analysis, what inevitably happens is you get some results, and it prompts more questions that then can lead you down a path that might lead you to somewhere that is actually, you know, pretty surprising. But yes, I don't think it's necessarily easy to be able to find the answer directly. It takes some work.
Yeah, it reminds me of a question that I had around what skill sets makes a successful user of big data. Can you maybe just comment on a few skill sets?
Well, I think the first thing is that you need to have the technological know-how, and that's definitely where actuarial science comes into it. The skills that you learn through becoming an actuary are definitely very applicable when it comes to working with data. But I think the other side of it is that you also have to be you have to be able to ask questions and have a creative sort of way of looking at problems, because otherwise, you can get lost within the data. Just, you know, there's endless sort of models and tests I'm sure that you can do on it, but it might not lead you anywhere commercial. And that's, I suppose, the key.
That's the concern that I suppose you could have around navel gazing and spurious accuracy, just trying to keep at those models all the time. Do we have any more questions from the floor? We've got one more from David, I think.
Yes, that's right. Practical question. I used to do this a little bit years back, and one of the problems I found was the comment that the data gets really big. We're talking gigabytes upon gigabytes, and the analysis required, the queries you have to do, can take substantial amounts of time. I was just curious, from a practical perspective, what kind of software are you using, what kind of infrastructure, hardware infrastructure are you using? Are we looking at things like PostgreSQL, solid-state drives and R, or are you using your own custom-built software? Just curious.
I'm not sure I can answer that question, I'm sorry. But you're right, the computing power that needs to go into being able to query these big databases is pretty sizable.
Substantial. All right, one last question and then we'll break. While this question is stepping up, just a reminder to please complete your feedback on FSF Connect.
Yeah, hi, it's Wayne Tubman here. It's less of a question. I thought I might answer some of the others. In answer to your question, we actually use off-the-shelf hardware. We use Microsoft SQL, we use solid-state drives. But in answer to a few of the other questions about big data, it's not about the old cliche, it's not size that matters, it's what you do with it. And I think that the reason actuaries are so important in what we do and what any business would be doing in terms of analytics is combining that mathematical and technical know-how with the commercial and sort of inspirational side. So certainly whenever we approach any problem, it's about all those hypotheses and thinking about how you would approach them. So thinking to Melissa's example of Henry Ford and the car, whenever we start something, it's really important to think laterally and think about, well, what's a better way of approaching this? And then seeking out data sets or approaches that might be relevant to it. So the way that we tackle the big question is actually thinking about, well, what's relevant here? And using intuition, but then potentially applying statistical techniques like principal component analysis to crunch the problem down. But personally, I feel that actuaries have a lot to contribute here. Other professions are certainly solid in the analytics space, but they might attack it in a quite different way to an actuary. They'll attack it with computational power or statistical analysis. And actuaries, I think, are a good way to bridge those things and approach it in, I think, a unique way. And certainly it's the way we approach it in all of our work.
Thank you for that. I was actually going to ask how big is big. I think that comment answered. Thank you so much. I'd like to ask you to put your hands together for Melissa and her presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.